Acts 6 is where we've stopped. Acts 6, we were sort of working on verses 3 through 4. I want to say a few more things about those two verses, and then we'll pick up with Acts 6, 5. You may remember that the disciples, there's this murmuring, Acts chapter 6, verse 1, between some widows, the Grecians and the Hebrews. Some were being neglected in the daily distribution of food, and the 12 were aware of the problem. They called the group of the disciples, that is the church, together and said, look, we need some help here. We're involved in too many things, basically. So in verse 3, he says, look ye out therefore, brethren, from among you seven men of good report, full of spirit and of wisdom, whom we may appoint over this business. But we will continue steadfastly in prayer and in the ministry of the word. One of the things that we ended on last week was the discussion as far as binding and non-binding examples. There are some items in Scripture which, as we look at them, we would say that that is a binding example, something that we need to follow today. There would be some other examples in Scripture where we would look at them and say that is not binding today. Ray mentioned foot washing, John chapter 13. That would be an example, but it is a non-binding example. We would have, for example, the example of Judas. He killed himself. That is certainly an example, but is a non-binding example. Here you also have an example of some men being appointed. That would be a binding example, but you have the number of men. We would, I think, argue that that is a non-binding example. For example, let's suppose that you had a congregation of all women. If you were to continue to meet, you couldn't follow the example, right? You couldn't find seven men, seven males, because they didn't exist. Or you might have a congregation where you only have three males. So it's not the number, it is the principle. As you look at the end of verse 3, the King James and the American Standard both use the word business. That's an important word. It means need, it means duty, it means task, and you can probably get that from the context. You have the same term being used by Jesus in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 8. One of the things that interests me is how the ladies, who are the widows, are described. They are described in what I would think of as a fairly compassionate way. How are they not described? Maybe we can look at it in that way. What are they not called? I'll give you a little more assistance. I'm thinking in negative terms. Something bad could have been said about them. These are who?
Believing Christians.
Christian. Well, they were. But I'm thinking about some descriptions which are not favorable. Some negative descriptions. Well, I'm thinking, oh, they're a bunch of benevolent cases. They're poor people. They were not described in any way which would be negative, any way which was derogatory. Both in English and in Greek, you have expressions of dignity, and I think that's significant for us to mention. Certainly, they were important enough to be brought to the attention of the apostles, and even though we have no longer apostles, we do have today God's plan for church leadership, and you see that reflected in the we. The people who were in charge here were willing to take on this responsibility, and that should be true for church leadership today. The apostle said, we need to free ourselves from this task, so what can we do? We can continue in the verse 4. All right, we're going to continue in prayer. We're also going to persist in the ministry of the word. So they were familiar with that. Now, we've talked about that word steadfastly before. If you probably don't remember any of those discussions, but just seeing that word steadfastly, what comes to mind? All right, devotion would be one good expression of it. What else?
Continuous.
All right, continuous. And if you go back and maybe you can recall that discussion a little bit, this is like that stubborn persistence. This is the word which describes we're never going to give up. We're going to keep working at this because this is really, really important. Constant attention would be associated with this term. So we see it back in Acts 1, verse 14, Acts 2, verse 42, and then also in Acts chapter 8, verse 13. You also have here a quick reference, but I think an important reference to prayer. How much attention do you draw out from Acts chapter 6, 3 and 4, as far as the apostles and their focus on prayer? Yeah. I think for a lot of people, they kind of look at prayer as, well, if we have time or if we get time or if we think about it, we'll pray. That was not the apostles' mindset when it came to prayer. I don't know how much they prayed prior to this time, but it seems to me that they perhaps had probably learned a few things about prayer. They were doing this in a very consistent, a very persistent, a very steadfast way. Any suggestions that you want to throw out why they may have been a little more steadfast in prayer now than they were before? We don't know about their prayer life before, but there may have been some things which called them to be more prayerful. Why pray more, perhaps?
I would think that after they've seen the crucifixion of Christ and his resurrection, and that how steadfast he was in his devotion to God. And eventually they realized that he returned to heaven and
Yeah, now they've sort of got the fuller picture. As they're working with Jesus, okay, you know, maybe a prophet, a great man, certainly he's of God. Not quite sure everything that's going on, but we're going to stick with him. Great rabbi. But then after the crucifixion, the resurrection, he is the Son of God. Yes, we now know who we're serving. So that knowledge, that additional knowledge, certainly should have been an incentive. Glenda, anything from you? Okay, I think you have to include that as well. Anything else?
Wasn't the church rapidly growing then, which would keep it in the forefront of your mind to pray?
I think you have to add that as well. If you look at it from a secular perspective, if you have somebody that has gone into business and the business is growing by leaps and bounds, what's going to be on their mind all the time? They did $500,000 in sales last year. This year they're going to do $5 million. If you're that business owner, what do you think you're going to be thinking about day in and day out, 7 days a week? You're going to be thinking about the business, right? Are we going to go backwards? Are we going to go forward? How do we keep it going? What are going to be the new issues? Do we need more insurance? Do we need more people? Do we need more space? All those things are going to be on your mind because of that expansive growth. Now, here you have 12 people, which should have allowed them to spread out the responsibility a little bit, but that is a lot to manage. And trying to keep all these. Do you think they had any problems in the church other than Ananias and Sapphira? Acts 5?
Yeah, they had people.
Yeah, they had people. So you can imagine, almost like Moses, he needs some help to deal. No, they don't have millions and millions, we don't think. Perhaps like he had close to a million. But still, they've got several thousand people. And people being people, they had some issues. All right, who raised the next hand? Stan, that may have been you. Or no, it was Betty. I'm sorry. We'll go to you and then go to Stan. So it becomes important from that perspective as well. I'm going to tag a little bit more onto that. The apostles, they needed to continue to receive some information from God. The New Testament wasn't written. Some have suggested, and this may be exactly right, that they were receiving divine revelation through prayer. I can see a need for that as they're dealing with people, as that teaching needs to continue. We need to instruct these people in the ways of God, and perhaps God was, little by little, also revealing some Christian truths through prayer. Stan?
Well, as you mentioned, when you've got a rapidly growing business, in this case, you're constantly thinking about what you're going to do in order to keep that business going well. But also, when you're in charge of an event, and as the event gets closer and closer, you put your mind more and more to it, to the point when that last day comes, you're probably not thinking about anything else. Well, those people were anticipating that Christ was going to come very soon. And so that may have been a factor also, thinking that, the end of time is going to come, even though they didn't know when it was, but we're expecting it very soon. That might have precipitated.
That's true. That very well could have played into this. The other item that I would mention is persecution. When the heat starts getting turned up in that way, people are often inclined to pray more. You know, God help us, God see us through this. So you have multiple reasons for why I think they are talking about the ministry of the word and also to continue steadfastly in prayer. One other quick point, and then we will move on from there. Look at verse 5, unless there's anything that you want to add or ask. The word ministry. We looked at that word back when we were talking about verse 1. Here it reminds us, I think, that congregations and individuals can have a so-called ministry. You have the same word being used over in the book of Colossians, chapter 4 and verse 17. The other point that I want to make on that is that a lot of people can have a ministry. But is a ministry necessarily of God or approved of God? No. So when a person talks about, oh, we have this great ministry, well, it might be great, but it's not necessarily something that has God's approval. So be careful of that word. Anything that you want to add or ask before we start with Acts 6, verse 5? Stan?
Well, going back to verse 3, and this whole episode here is a real mixed bag of things as far as example and what is not to be used as example. We take some very general things out of it, I think, but my question is, how much do we count as example or as not an example to follow the look ye out among you seven men? In other words, the apostles evidently left it to the group to select who these men were going to be. And I know we've been enough different places to know there's, how do we select deacons? How do we select our leadership? And whether this plays into that.
Well, it could have had that entire class today, but I left those notes at home. So we'll probably have to just kind of summarize that. But when you look, for example, let's take a look at a parallel passage. Let's go over to the book of Titus. We'll look at the first chapter, verse 5. Remember, Titus was another preacher. He had some association with Paul. And in Titus 1:5, Paul is writing to Titus. He said, "For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldest set in order the things that were wanting, and appoint elders in every city, as I what? As I gave you charge." That to me is a significant point. Not that there is a plan which says follow these steps, A, B, C, D, E, and F. But there is this need, and this is my inspired will, that you put elders in every city and you have some part in the process. Now, how exactly did it unfold? Again, the example here is we don't know. We know what was done. We know who did it. We know who commanded it. But as far as the specifics, as far as the procedures that he followed, that's not given. And I think there may be some divine wisdom there. As he was working in cities A and B, these guidelines or these procedures might have worked as he was helping these congregations. But he moves maybe to congregations on the other side of the island. Maybe he's dealing with congregations that are radically different, people who are of a very different mindset. He needed to follow some different procedures. So you do have limited guidance in Scripture as far as I can see, as far as some basic things. For example, a decent and orderly process, you could make that conclusion from 1 Corinthians chapter 14. If you've got some existing leadership within the congregation, that to me would be an example that you could pull from Acts chapter 6, that they would need to take some part in that process to bring people forward. But for the most part, you have some leeway when it comes to installing elders and deacons. Anything you want to add or ask there?
No.
Okay, I'm just going to leave it there because, as I said, that could consume at least an entire class. Anybody else want to comment before we look at Acts 6:5? Okay. "And thing pleased the whole multitude, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith and of the Holy Spirit, and Philip, and Proscorus, and Nicanor, and Timon, and Parmenas, and Nicholas, a proselyte of Antioch." When you look at the decision that's described in Acts chapter 6, how many people did it please?
All of them.
You have to look at that passage and almost scratch your head. When it comes to deciding on whether or not you're going to get a pet, where you're going to go for vacation, what you're going to eat for supper, sometimes within the family there's not agreement on those basic things. So here to have an agreement which pleased apparently thousands of people, it in my mind is a little surprising that all those people would be happy with what was decided. But that is what we read about. So given the size of the congregation in Jerusalem at this time, that is amazing. The word which is translated multitude has the sense of congregation or the whole body of believers. Now, when you look at that word which is translated pleased, it's an interesting word. Rather than just say, well, okay, we're not really happy with that, or this wouldn't have been our direction had we been in charge, that we would have gone. It's a word which really means pleased. Remember over there in the book of Matthew chapter 14 and verse 6, there was the young lady that danced, Herod saw her. And remember what word is said or used in conjunction? Herod was pleased by the dance. Well, he isn't thinking, that's just kind of okay. I mean, he's so pleased that what's he offer? Up to half his kingdom. And then as you look at this word, Romans 15 verse 3 says Jesus did not come to please himself. It's also used in Romans chapter 8 and verse 8. There are a couple of other passages as well. But in Romans 8:8, those who live in the flesh cannot do what? They cannot please God. So if your translation uses the word please or a similar word, it really does mean please. It really does mean something along the lines of satisfy. So as you look at the seven men and you go back and you look at the names, they each had a Greek name. I would conclude from that they were probably Hellenists. When we think about Hellenists, they were the people who had been exposed to some part of Greek culture, likely trained in Greek culture. They would have thought in Greek. They would have spoken in Greek and so forth and educated in Greek. So when it came time to help the Grecian widows in Acts chapter 6, they probably would have been naturally inclined to assist those ladies. Now, when you think about that, the problem is with the Grecians, the Hebrew widows are apparently being cared for okay, and yet the saying pleased how many people? All the folks. Do you think the Hebrew widows were included in that? Yeah. Do you think they, looking at people in general, could have had a basis to object? Yeah. You're getting your helpers from where? From the complainers, right? To be fair, just trying to kind of go back and look at this circumstance, to be fair, who do we need? Yeah, we need some of the people from a Hebrew background to make sure that things don't get weighted so heavily towards them. So it really is amazing to me that they were willing to accept seven men. But these men, as we mentioned last time, they were to be of good, remember, good report. And that means that they were to have a good reputation. So they believed that they were going to be fair, and that's apparently what was done.
What gives you the impression that they were all taken from the Greek men and not a combination of the Greek and Hebrew men?
Well, the names. As you go back and you look at the names, they're associated with Greek culture and Greek life. Glenda? Well, you've got two Antiochs in the Bible. One would be Antioch of Pisidia, and then you've got the other Antioch. Let's go back and take a look at that. A proselyte of Antioch. For him, I'd have to go back and look and do a little looking. If that was Pisidia or the other one. Offhand, I can't give you an answer to that. Yeah, you've got two that you can find in the map. So. Anytime geography comes up, even if it's local, I've got to go back and take a careful look at it. My sense of direction is so bad, I went out to the fair one more time Friday night. They parked me out in the back 40. And I knew if I came out after dark, I was not going to find my vehicle. So I had my phone. I used my GPS car locator app. So my app worked. The unfortunate part was when it was dark, I got turned around. And to get out of the fair, I had to scale some fences. And I mean, it was like being on a marine obstacle course or breaking out of jail. So like I say, my local geography is not good. My worldwide geography is even worse. So I will go back and look at that. But I tell you that little shameful story to let you know. That is just not a strong point for me. But anyway, I did find the truck and glad nobody was with me. So yeah, she's my map. So anyway, all right, that was free. Anybody else want to ask a question that maybe I can answer?
Did you download the GPS all the way?
Yeah, I had that on the phone as well. So, but anyway, that's all true. All right, so we've got two fellas that we'll say a little bit more about, Stephen and Philip. We do have them mentioned a little later in the book of Acts. We've got some information about Stephen in Acts chapter 7. That's going to be in the next chapter, obviously. And we've also got some information about him in Acts 11, verses 19 to 24. You also have some information about Philip a little later in the book. I think Luke may have said a little bit more about Stephen, especially in Acts chapter 6, because in Acts chapter 7, we're going to read more about him. And there's going to be a lot more about him, and he finally dies. So perhaps it's kind of a prelude to his martyrdom to set the stage for what's going to happen to him. Maybe that's why we've got a little more attention here. Philip, you may remember that in Acts chapter 21, what's mentioned as far as his family. He has four daughters who were able to prophesy. They were that old. Now, because of that, if those daughters were his natural children, and there's no reason to believe that that is not the case, then they're old enough to being able to prophesy at that time. may suggest that he was married at the time in Acts chapter 6. That naturally then brings forth the question, was he a deacon? Is that what we're talking about in Acts chapter 6? And we'll discuss that in just a little bit. When you look at the other five men, they are never again mentioned in the New Testament. Not a word of information about them. Now, in and of itself, that may not seem to be too significant, but I think that there are a couple lessons from there. If you were looking at this on your own, you checked out these seven guys, and you know that five of them are never mentioned again in the New Testament. Any lesson that you could draw from that? Practical lesson? Comforting lesson? All right, I think that's basic lesson. Whether it's your local congregation or whether it's a church in general, here are five guys. They were doing a work that in many respects was service-based. We have discussed in other classes that if you are involved with service-based work, a lot of times that is the lowliest of the low. You're serving tables, you're waiting on tables. That can be, especially out there in the world, a work, a job where you are involved with people who are grumpy. We already know that some people were unhappy. And you may not get much appreciation for it. So for those who are well-known, God certainly can use them. For those who are not known widely or not known at all outside the local congregation, they are certainly still very, very important in God's eyes. The second lesson, and this is sort of related to the first, is that when you think about the fellows who are here, were they as fine as people like Paul? Fine as people like Timothy? Sure. Not as well known. But just because you are not well known outside your local congregation, your Christian life can be just as fine, just as good as someone who is not known very well. Now, one more quick point. This fellow who is Nicanor, there are some ancient sources, not a ton, but there are a few ancient sources that suggest that he became an apostate and formed the heir of the Nicolaitans that you read about in Revelation chapter 2, verses 6 and 15. I don't set much stock by that, but I do mention that in case you have a footnote in your Bible, or maybe you looked at a commentary before you came, or maybe that was in the back of your memory. But you do find, I think, people sometimes, we live in a world where people like the sensational. And any time that they can dig up some dirt on somebody, or any time that they can bring out some information which maybe sounds a little sleazy, or man, we can slime that guy, look at what he did. So, as I say, I don't think that there's hardly any evidence for that at all, but there are some people who have that idea. Anything else that you want to add or ask before we talk about deacons for a bit? Stan?
Well, relative to the fact that you don't have to be mean, you don't have to be well-known, you don't have to be considered to be important. If you go stick with that exact time, it says that they went everywhere preaching the gospel, and then later on it says that the word was spread throughout the world. So, we know there were a lot of people out there
right.
that aren't named in the scriptures that were doing some very important work to God.
Yeah. It reminds you a little bit of an incident in Jesus' life where the apostles saw a fellow casting out a demon and they went running back to the Lord and said, you know, we don't know about this guy. And then Jesus gives them sort of a veiled answer, he that is not against me is with me. Well, we wouldn't apply that across the board. There would be some cases where that is not quite like we would explain it. But again, the point there to them was, hey, look, leave this guy alone. You don't know who he is, but he's one of my servants. He's doing the Father's will. And yet today there are a lot of people who are doing that in local congregations. You know, whether it's mowing the grass or whether it's teaching somebody, taking a meal to a person who has a need, helping somebody move, a lot of different ways people help. And sometimes I think they look at those acts and think, well, nobody knows and nobody cares and does God even see it? But when you look at Acts chapter 6, that's a lesson that you need to take home, that a lot of the fellows who are involved with this, the five, may not have gotten much appreciation. We hope that was not true, but still, God knew and they did a valuable work. Anybody else? All right, let's spend some time thinking about whether or not these guys were deacons. That is a natural question. We know from 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 8 through 13, and Philippians chapter 1, verse 1, that there were deacons in the first century church, and some say deacons originated here in Acts chapter 6. Others would say that is not correct. So I'll give you quickly three views that sort of sum this up. The first view, and I'll not necessarily say which view is my view, but the first view argues that we have in Acts chapter 6 the creation and the installation of deacons. It is argued that we know from Philippians 1 verse 1 that deacons are a part of church organization, and the church has now been in existence for a few years. It was time for deacons to come into existence, and we have a need, so it was only natural that deacons be put into the church. If deacons were not appointed at this time, then the question becomes, when were they first appointed? Now, Luke does not use, I should have brought out the board today, but Luke does not use the exact word for deacon in Acts chapter 6 and verse 1. The exact word would be spelled D-I-A-K-O-N-O-S. D-I-A-K-O-N-O-S. And you can see how deacon would come from that word. But even though he doesn't use the exact word, he uses a form of the word. And that word would be spelled D-I-A-K-O-N-I-A. So again, D-I-A-K-O-N-O-S would be the word for deacon. You just switch the last two letters, I-A. So it's very, very close. It is a form of the word, and that's translated ministration in the ASV that we've already looked at. And that word means service or ministry. Then in Luke chapter 6 and verse 2, you have basically the same word again, D-I-A-K-O-N-E-O. So even though it is not the exact word for deacon, it is about as close as you can get. It is a form of the word. So those who believe that we have deacons in Acts chapter 6 say, look, you have two times basically the word deacon. These fellows are serving as deacons. You have more than one. Everything fits, so they must be deacons. Maybe that's true. Option number two. There would be some people who would look at this chapter and they would say that these fellows were serving in a temporary capacity. There was this function that existed for a while. We have the persecution that is going to be read about and studied about in Acts chapter 8. That's going to drive people away from Jerusalem, and perhaps that ends the need here. But they're going to offer some help for a period of time, and they're going to function in the way that they did. It was designed to meet a specific need. So they may not have had the exact title, but they certainly did the work that was associated with deacons. A little bit later, the church, maybe through that prayerful revelation of the apostles, they begin to appoint deacons in local congregations, and then that's why we read about that office in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Philippians chapter 1. Then there is another idea, which is sort of an offshoot of that one. It says that deacons were, again, coming along later. And what we have in Acts chapter 6 is sort of a temporary function, but the function was more in line with elders. Just as elders took some responsibility later for handling money, that would be over in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 11 and verse 30. So these fellows were appointed to serve in a somewhat similar capacity. Maybe they dealt with money. They certainly had some involvement with food. This view argues that this was a short-term task. Don't know exactly how long it lasted. And it claims that there is no parallel to this in the New Testament, that this was a unique situation. This arose, and this is what people needed to do for a period of time. It did not continue past the first century. So those are basically the three views. Now, I will remind you of something that we've already looked at. Let's go back to the fifth chapter of Acts for a second. There may not be a parallel here, but I do think it's worth mentioning. Acts chapter 5, verse 6, we have the death of Ananias and Sapphira. After the death of one, that would be Ananias, the husband, what do you have in verse 6? And who showed up? And the young men arose. Who were they? Were they teenagers? Were they people in the 20s, 30s? Were they married, unmarried? We don't know. But there were these young men who arose. They wrapped him around and carried him out and buried him. And then Sapphira shows up. She also dies. And then in verse 10, and she fell down immediately at his feet and gave up the ghost. And who? Once again, and the young men, presumably those same guys, maybe the exact same ones, maybe from that same group, came in and found her dead, and they carried her out and buried her by her husband. So it's, I guess, sort of a fourth view. There have been some individuals who have gone back and said, look, we had these young men, and maybe even had deacons back as early as Acts chapter 5, verses 6 and 10. Maybe that's a possibility. So at best, we can say without doubt that you have these fellows, they were willing to help, there was a need that they were able to meet, and they did the work of deacons, even if they were not specifically called deacons at this time. So that's kind of long and short as far as whether or not these guys were deacons. Anything you want to add or ask on that point, Gary?
Interesting, it says the young men instead of some young men. Like the seems to be there, it's more specific, but maybe I'm just reading.
Yeah, again, as I say, there are some people who would look at that and say there was a select group of young men. But today we might do the same thing. For example, if we're thinking about the teenagers, we might say the young people. So that may not be absolutely definitive, but there have been some people who have gone back there and tried to make that case that there were deacons as early as Acts chapter 5. So again, it's not completely out of the realm of possibilities, but you do have some young people and men able to carry on the work that you have in Acts chapter 6.
Well, they could have just been like church officials, like we have a treasurer. Is Brian still our treasurer?
He is.
But before he was a deacon, he was a treasurer.
Right.
So he was, I would call that a church official. But it doesn't say anything about elders here, and it's not talking about the qualifications, all that. So I guess I never looked at it that these men were deacons.
Yeah, and that there would be some who could make that argument, or probably have, that you don't have elders here. The apostles are serving as the overseers of this congregation, and at a later time, the church becomes more organized in the sense of Philippians 1. You do have elders. Titus certainly was told to go and appoint elders. And you also have deacons showing up at a later time as well. The apostles and men who were willing to serve in the ways that were needed, Acts 5 and Acts 6, were used. And then church organization becomes filled out at a later time. So, Trace?
Sorry.
Okay. Ray?
You used the Greek words for deacons. Is there any word similar to that in the Hebrew that might have been used in the Old Testament? I know we had the priest, the high priest, and the other priests that helped around the tabernacle and the things that needed to be done there. So would they have been the same workers that we might see in the New Testament?
Maybe. I'd have to go back and do some looking as far as any type of parallel there. I've never, in my recollection, come across that. And like I say, maybe it's there, but nothing sticks in my head as far as ever seeing that.
Okay.
That it? Stan?
Well, I think you've tried to point this out. You have to be really careful with the book of Acts because it's a transition period. And we know that the gifts came and went. We know that doctrine wasn't fully revealed at that time, and Paul makes some comment, I think, about the fact that at that time it wasn't real clear, but that we would see it more clear later. It seems to me like a lot of things, and this one would fall into the category, maybe they were deacons, maybe they weren't. I prefer to think of them more as maybe proto-deacons, something that preceded what was then finally established and solidified at a later time.
Yeah. If we're right, as far as what we've maintained up to this point concerning spiritual gifts, that is, only the apostles up to this point had spiritual gifts. We know, as time marched on, that as congregations become established, those congregations began to receive spiritual gifts. So there were additional items that were added later. And there would then be no problem in arguing that deacons or elders or spiritual gifts or additional revelation. I mean, when you start looking at the letters, for example, First and Second Thessalonians would be one example. First and Second Corinthians would be another example. There are some things that get sorted out little by little, and it wasn't like God just dumped everything on people. We today understand incremental change or incremental starts as far as, I remember when Teresa and I had some involvement with the Hummer plant. Teresa and I were both told that the first vehicles that they were building, I can remember the guy, he said we had stacks and stacks of paper when we rolled the first truck off the line. He said they didn't run. Now, I don't have any experience with RVs, but can you imagine an automobile? You're buying number 50, not me. I don't want that. But I mean, he just said we started throwing the paper away. He said the problems were just, so many, we almost didn't know where to start. And the church wasn't like that, but again, in principle, when you're starting something like that, you just can't dump it all on people and expect them all to, figure it out and everything works out. So you have to, little by little, start working through some things, whether you're building trucks or something else that is complicated, or in this case, starting a church. You're transitioning from one religion, the Old Testament, to the New. For the Jew, that was a huge, huge switch. And just to say, we're going to flip the light switch and, hey guys, we're done. God gave them 40 years to figure out, we're done. And then finally, you know, pulled the temple apart and destroyed Jerusalem and the records and so forth. So he was kind during that transition period instead of just saying, okay, guys, we're done and now figure it out on your own. So we do need to bear in mind God's character as we said to that question. Is that it? Betty. Yes.
Like whenever they were deacons, when you're choosing deacons and elders, the type of men, they just broke it down further for them later.
Right.
At this point, they were supposed to be well attested. In other words, men that were well reputed for the spirit and of wisdom.
Yeah.
So,
when you compare that to the qualifications of deacons, the only thing which would really seem to be at odds would be whether or not they were married. Because you've got guys who are good reputation, using good sense and so forth, that pretty much summarizes the qualities for a deacon.
Well, we know that Philip was
married. Yes, presumably he's married at this particular time, so yes. And it would have made sense for these fellows to have, you know, had a wife and maybe had some kids and been sensitive to the needs of a woman rather than taking single guys who may not have been sensitive to that. And that may dovetail well with Stan's comment that these were sort of prototypes. So you're setting that down, and then maybe they could refer back, way back when, in Jerusalem, we needed some men. These were the qualifications. We're spelling them out now with more specificity. Okay, let's look at Acts chapter 6 and verse 6. So whoever these guys were, deacons or not, whom they set before the apostles, and when they'd prayed, they laid their hands upon them. Seven guys are selected. Maybe they're all married. Maybe they're mainly married. We don't know for sure. They're brought before the apostles. The apostles first pray, and then what do? They put their hands on them. That's important. Later in the book of Acts, we're going to see in Acts chapter 8 and verse 18, plus Acts chapter 19 and verse 6, that the laying on of hands was designed to convey spiritual gifts. I am not convinced that the laying on of hands in Acts chapter 6 was designed to convey any spiritual gifts, because we don't read about any special powers. You also, as you think about giving out food to the widows, distributing, that was a word that I wanted. All right, giving food, helping with food distribution for the widows, would they have needed any miraculous gifts for that? Probably don't need to speak in tongues. I mean, they've already got the Greek language if they came from the Greek culture, and the other gifts probably would not have been very helpful. But you do, as you think about the laying on of hands, do find that especially in this culture, and even prior to this culture, in this part of the world, that this was an ancient practice. As you go back to the book of Genesis, you find that people, Genesis 48 would be an example of this, Genesis 48 verses 14 and 15, 17 and 18, you have, for example, men like Jacob. You know, sons come, and he's going to lay his hands on them. It's time to give them a blessing. You'll have some other examples as well. Back in the book of Numbers, chapter 27, verses 18 through 23, that was an account where they were trying to bestow authority on someone. You're going to receive authority. Today we do that a little differently. How do we show someone authority, or we're giving them authority, or we're recognizing them, giving them honor, showing that they've achieved or attained something? How do we do it? We may not put our hands on them, but what do we do? Well, okay. A handshake might be one way that we do it. What else?
Give them a title.
All right, we give them a title. That might be another way. What about graduation time? How do we show honor to a graduate? Well, we might give them a certificate. Anything else?
Money.
Oh, there you go. I thought if I shook myself long enough, we'd get that answer. All right, we might give them a graduation gown, right? They get the cap and they get the gown and so forth, and we're saying, you are a graduate. You have achieved this level of education. You have, when you go back to the Old Testament, Leviticus chapter 16, verses 20 through 22. Remember the scapegoat? Before that goat was sent into the wilderness, what happened? Put the hand on the goat, and then it's symbolically going to carry the sins away into the wilderness. 1 Timothy 5:22. This is probably in the context of elders, could be deacons there. Paul told Timothy, lay hands on no man how. Anybody remember that key word? Don't put your hands on anybody hastily. Remember that verse? So he was warning about that. Not that that was going to do something miraculous, but it was don't appoint anybody in a hasty manner. And then Jesus, Luke chapter 18 and verse 15. What's the Lord do? He's out there with the apostles, and he's doing what to kids? Touching them. He's putting his hands. And this is one of the occasions where the apostles show up and they say, get away. He doesn't have time for you. You know, we've got other stuff to do. And Jesus said, let the little children come to me. Why do you think the Lord was touching kids? Putting his hands on them. Why? Well, okay, I think innocence is maybe one answer.
Blessing.
All right, encouragement, blessing. The future, these are the people who belong to the kingdom and so forth. So the laying on of hands, it's used many, many different ways. It's used for many, many different things in Scripture. And here, it has to be, I think, understood in some of the senses that we've looked at. You have a lot of women who are unhappy, and we'd probably be unhappy too if we were not getting food on a regular basis. And the apostles have these seven guys brought before them, and they pray. That prayer should have helped set the tone. And then by laying their hands on these guys, what do you think the apostles are doing? They're saying, these are the guys. You have a problem, and who's going to fix it? These seven. So if you have an issue as this problem is being worked, who do you need to see? These guys. Now, do you think the apostles were willing to deal with an issue if the seven couldn't solve it? I suspect that they could and would. But still, at the same time, you have here a delegation of authority. You have here a delegation of power. You have, by the laying on of the hands, these seven guys being put in charge. And it's a way of saying, remember what we just studied? We're going to give ourselves to prayer and ministry of the word, and we're going to use these seven guys to take care of this other important area. So we're going to lay our hands on them. So that's exactly what they're going to start doing, and hopefully soon. Anything you want to add or ask? Okay, we've got 3 minutes left in Acts chapter 6 and verse 7. That is not a good stopping place. Let's at least read it. And the word of God increased. Now, I wonder if maybe there's a connection between that. The apostles, remember what they said we're going to do? We're going to give ourselves to prayer, ministry of the word. We've got our seven helpers, and now what happens? The word of God is increasing. It sounds like the plan was working very, very well. And the number of disciples multiplied in Jerusalem exceedingly, and a great company of the priests were obedient to the faith. That is a very, very interesting verse for a lot of reasons. A lot of priests were turning to the gospel, and they were being converted, but we can't talk about it today.